I'm Alan Wardis, and you're listening to Think Radio.
I never thought I would be learning about antibiotic resistance and timber harvest at the same time, or
microplastics.
Or if the Uinta Wilderness has a wolverine present or absent. All those issues, you know, come into the organization and we get to learn about them.
That's Merrill Warren, development manager for an out-of-the-box organization called Adventure Scientists. The group pairs up researchers in need of hard-to-come-by data from remote corners of the world with the adventurers who are headed there anyway. It's the kind of grassroots thinking that's transforming how things get done. Stay tuned for the whole conversation on this episode of Think Radio.
Think Radio is supported by the Gunnison Country Times, Gunnison's locally owned hometown newspaper, and by listeners like you. To find out how you can become a Think Radio supporter, visit kbut.org.
Merrill, thanks for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I've really been looking forward to this conversation because since we met a few days ago, I've realized I had no idea that such a thing as adventure scientists even existed. So I think I'm not alone in that. A lot of people would probably say the same thing. So, well, because adventure and science are not words that we normally associate with each other. So help us out. What is Adventure Scientists?
We are a nonprofit, and what we do is provide partners who are working to address environmental issues, whether that be World Resources Institute, Harvard Medical School, the U.S. Forest Service, and others, with the data they need to push those efforts forward. And we do that by sending people like me, avid adventurers who love to ski and climb and hike and sail and you name it, into the remote corners of the world to collect the data that is otherwise just inaccessible to those folks.
And so these adventurers, they're going to these places anyway, right? A lot of times?
A lot of times, yeah. Our projects sort of fall into two veins. First being that, adventurers at large. We just wrapped up 4 years now of sampling for our microplastics project, for which we collected this enormous global data set of water samples. And that was collected by surfers, sailors, rafters, water recreationalists around the world. And that data is now being used to influence manufacturing processes. It's being used by government to inform decisions. It's being used to really get a picture of how microplastics is pervasive across the world. Our other model is more of a place-based approach, and that is, for example, our partnership with World Resources Institute this summer, where we have hikers, backpackers, mountain bikers all along the West Coast from Southern California up into Canada who are collecting a genetic database on a big leaf maple, which is a tree species that has a history of being targeted by the illegal timber trade.
Mm-hmm.
And that genetic database is going to make these tools useful that can identify those shipments in real time and allow for a disruption of that trade. So we're asking those volunteers to go to certain sites that they might not otherwise be going to.
I see. So
because that's a location-based effort.
Right. And so on one side of this equation, you've got scientists working for scientific organizations, universities, research institutes, et cetera.
And government.
And government.
Yeah.
And they're working on various projects. And at the other end of the spectrum, on the other side of the equation, you've got people who are out in the world doing their thing. Where'd this idea come from to put them together? Because knowing what I know about how research budgets are formed, there's not money to hire all of these people to send out and collect thousands and thousands of water samples, for example, around the world. Well, where'd this idea come from to solve that problem by just tapping into the people who are already out there?
Sure. So our executive director, Greg Trinish, came up with this idea over Chinese food.
Many ideas are born over Chinese food.
You know, it's a stroke of inspiration. But that inspiration was informed by years and years of pursuing outdoor adventure for his own purposes. He hiked the length of the Andes with a friend. He hiked the entire Appalachian Trail and had experiences along those through hikes that really made him feel selfish. And I think that's something that a lot of us can relate to. I certainly have felt that way working in the outdoor industry or pursuing my own summits for my own joy and realizing that those places that we all go play are at risk. And
well, and you hear that criticism a lot about outdoor adventure, that these people are flying X number of miles to get where they're going and, you know, the trash that's littering the flanks of Everest, all of that stuff is in the news. So what Greg said was, hey, I'm not okay with that.
Yeah, and he said, gosh, there must be other people who feel this way as well. Why are we not harnessing this global community that has this unique skill set to access these incredibly remote areas? And they have the attention to detail, the ability to survive in extreme environments, whether that's deserts or glaciers or high mountain peaks. And they have the motivation. If you're willing to go climb a 14er, I think you're certainly willing to take a water sample while you're at it.
yeah.
It just makes sense.
Well, it does. And you mentioned an interesting point, and that is that these people have a particular skill set that a lot of scientists don't. So if you said to a scientist, okay, we want you to go up Mount Everest and take, you know, ice samples, the learning curve there would be enormous, right?
Absolutely. We work very closely with our partners to design the protocol. Because we are a volunteer-driven organization and we want to make sure the data quality we bring back to those partners is paramount. But what the scientist doesn't have, as you said, is the ability to access the place. And that's why we only take on projects that are uniquely suited to our network and our unique skill set, because the data we collect just simply can't be collected in any other way.
So what's an example of a project that you wouldn't take on? Because it
sure.
doesn't match.
You know, I can't think of a specific off my head, but I can make one up. I can tell you the ones we would take, certainly. What we wouldn't take is anything that can be done by a field tech or that could be done by not using the outdoor community that we work with. And so our three criteria that we run every project that comes into our organization through is, first and foremost, is there a unique need for our network? We don't want to apply our network to projects where that isn't true, because we do have a capacity that we can currently work on, and we want to make sure every project we do is having as much impact as we can.
Right.
The second is that issue currently data limited? So, for instance, climate change. We certainly work around the issue of climate change. We work on illegal timber harvest, which is a huge contributor to climate change. But simply going out to collect more data to prove that climate change is happening isn't going to push the needle forward there.
Right, that's been
happening.
Done.
and third, we only take on projects where there's a clear, tangible conservation outcome that's going to happen as a result of our efforts. And so if a partner comes to us and says, we're just interested in data for data's sake, for research purposes, but we don't have any action that we're going to take as a result of what we learn, we're not so interested in that. When projects do fit those three criteria, that's when the rubber really hits the road and we can begin developing a really exciting partnership.
Well, so having a science background myself, one of the first things that I thought when I heard about this organization was, yeah, but how do you ensure that the data is worth anything? I mean, there's such a rigorous standard that most researchers would apply. They would insist on a chain of custody and in a particular way that samples are handled. How do you take somebody who has no background in that and make them useful to scientists?
Sure. That's one of the questions we get first at most gatherings. That data quality is paramount for us, and that's how we set ourselves apart from other citizen science efforts. And citizen science and volunteer-driven data collection is so often purely for the engagement of the volunteer. And for us, that's a wonderful byproduct. The stories and the experiences and the education that our volunteers get through working with us is so important and yet secondary to the product that we provide to our partner. And we ensure the quality of that product in a myriad of ways, many ways, beginning with every single volunteer who comes into our programs going through a rigorous testing process where they learn our protocols and have to get 100% on a quiz just to be able to go out.
Really? It's pass-fail.
It's pass-fail to get out into the field. We use learning management systems that we've designed with our partners to make sure the protocols are taught in a way that our volunteers can really soak it in. We go as far as, you know, putting GoPros on our volunteers to randomly select to make sure protocols are being interpreted correctly and used well in the field. We do everything from having a volunteer hotline where our volunteer coordinator can answer questions in real time. And we have a scientific advisory board who are some of the most well-respected in their field who look through our protocols before we go live with any project.
Wow.
To be sure that the QAQC is rigorous enough that the data will be useful in the larger scientific community. And most importantly, we work so closely with our partners, whether that's, you know, Harvard asked us last year, 2 years ago now, to collect scat samples from around the world to help them in their effort to turn off antibiotic resistance in a clinical setting. And the protocol for picking up scat around the world was reviewed and built in collaboration with that researcher at Harvard so that when those scat samples showed up in the Harvard lab, they were of the utmost quality and useful for that study.
That's an interesting sell to the adventurers.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
So we want you to hike Kilimanjaro and collect poo.
I think that happened, actually. I think we had Komodo dragon. I think we had camel. Yeah, we got some good ones around the world.
Well, so I can imagine from the point of view of a scientist who's laboratory bound, right, most of the time, this must feel like Christmas Day to have, just like by magic, stuff start arriving that is useful for the study. What are you hearing from the scientists? What do they tell you about the usefulness of this? What's the feedback that you're getting?
Sure. Going back to that Harvard example, Mike Gilmore at the Harvard lab, who is our partner there, he has said that his work would not be where it is today without the reach that we were able to provide him. And through the data that we were able to collect, he's narrowed, he and his lab have narrowed the genes that they can trace back to being an ancestor for the Enterococcus bacteria, which is tied to antibiotic resistance, down from thousands. They were looking at thousands down to 93.
Wow.
And we're now discussing how to get our network back out into the field to further that. We're currently fundraising for that effort, co-fundraising with him. And we've had other researchers, like our partnership with Abby Barrows on this microplastic study that we've recently completed. The global reach that we were able to provide would have been unattainable without a global network of sailors and surfers.
And so not just because of geography and the, and the geographical range, but also because of time. I mean, if you send one team out to survey all of these different locations, that's going to take 5 years.
Right, yeah.
Whereas, you know, I would imagine your results were much faster.
Absolutely.
Well, so on the other side of that equation then, what are you hearing from the adventure community? How have they responded to being a part of something that's more than just going out and having a good time?
Yeah, that part's really fun. The storytelling component of all of this is really amazing. These passionate environmentalists who love to recreate in the outdoor come to us and say, we want to do something meaningful with our adventure. How can I do that? And so, for example, last summer, we've had volunteers in high mountain meadows across the West catching butterflies for us, for our principal investigator at University of Arizona. And that data is going to the Forest Service and other agencies to inform how they manage those high mountain ecosystems to protect biodiversity in those areas. But those volunteers come back and say, gosh, I never slowed down and looked at individual butterflies before. I'm seeing this place in a whole new way.
Wow.
Or just the feeling of fulfillment rather than feeling like, hey, I bagged a summit and that was great. But hey, I bagged a summit and man, I contributed to the protection of this place while I was at it. I think that is a widespread feeling in the outdoor community. And I think this is a really amazing way to provide a resource that just isn't available to scientists otherwise, while also creating a deeper engagement for those outdoor athletes that then turns them into ambassadors. You know, they go back to their communities, whether that's Salt Lake, whether that's base camp at Kilimanjaro, you name it, around the world.
And they're talking about it.
And they talk about it. And they say, hey, you know, this is a great way. You know, you should care about whether wolverines are present in the Uinta. You should care that, you know, our glaciers are melting in high mountain ecosystems.
And that works because they're able to now say, you should care because I figured out why it's important to care. I saw it with my own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I care because I was there. That's a whole different level of storytelling.
Yeah, and we actually, you know, a lot of our volunteers ask for more material from us about why they're out doing it, and we happily provide all that.
Yeah.
But we also survey them after their experience with us, and we've gotten, I think our average now is around 80% say they're more likely to pursue careers in conservation after volunteering with Adventure Scientists, just experiencing how fulfilling it can be.
Wow. So it's a recruitment tool also.
Yeah.
So that brings me to a question about you personally and your involvement and why, out of all the things that you could be doing, you're an anthropologist, you're pursuing a graduate degree in Master of Environmental Management at Western Colorado University. You could go in a lot of different directions. So I'm curious to know why this is the one that has really ignited your passion. How'd you get into this business?
Out of college, I was fresh off of an anthropology degree, but my real drive and my real passions lay in the environment. And I was dog mushing up on a glacier in Alaska where...
Wait, being an adventurer?
Yes, certainly. A paid adventurer, but yes. And groups were being flown in to experience this wild place via helicopter. They'd be there for 30 minutes. They'd get a quick tour and they'd be flown back off the glacier. And I remember thinking of the carbon footprint of that, standing there, living out there, really, I felt like I was the one having the experience because I got to live out there with 300 sled dogs and experience that wild landscape outside of Juneau. And I remember thinking, gosh, you know, these people get here, they exclaim over how gorgeous it is, and then they're whisked away.
Yeah.
Like, what if we could harness that excitement? And I didn't know adventure scientists existed either until I met Greg Trinish. Asked him to have lunch with me because I was starting to get my career going. And he said, hey, you want an internship? And I said, yeah. So 5 years ago now, I was counting bison for our partnership with American Prairie Reserve. We were counting wildlife up on their properties to help them understand what is out there, how to manage those landscapes. And doing that as an intern, getting some of the volunteer experience, and then coming back into the office and getting going in my, you know, more sedentary but certainly still adventurous career. You know, this really just, it is anthropology in a lot of ways, because I think the human experience and the earth that we all rely on, it, I mean, the outdoor community is a community, and we are all tied to the successes that this data can lead to, whether that's putting a stop to illegal timber harvest or on the more human health side of things, you know, making a breakthrough on antibiotic resistance, you know, that is anthropology, if you ask me.
Well, yes. So, well, for instance, in the valley where we're located, the Gunnison Valley in you know, the high mountains of Colorado, at the north end of this valley is Crested Butte. We're completely dependent on the ski industry there for economic growth and development. But climate change projections make it look very questionable whether we can actually continue that indefinitely as an industry here. So the more data we have to understand those things, I mean, that is absolutely an anthropological question. It just happens to be current, not looking backward, you know, hundreds or thousands of years. What's your favorite outdoor activity?
Oh, gosh. Currently mountain biking. But I lived here for a whole year after college. I actually moved to Crested Butte after college and spent a year. I worked at Pitas in Paradise.
Oh, so many people do.
Yeah.
That's such a common story.
It is, yeah. And then moved on to Bozeman, Montana after a year here, but really did fall in love with this landscape and somehow missed out on mountain biking. I lived here for that long and only found mountain biking in the last few years. So, but I'm also a skier and a sailor. So
it's the sailing that we could talk about a long time, but we're not going to right now. In your time with Adventure Scientists, what project would you point to and say, that's the coolest thing that we've done?
Oh, man. For me personally, I think any team member at Adventure Scientists would have a different answer to this. I think
sure.
They're all cool.
Yeah.
And that's the best part of working there is, especially for me, our project managers are more specialized into the one project they're working on. But for me, I get to learn every project that comes in the door. And that is so exciting for me. I get to learn, you know, I never thought I would be learning about antibiotic resistance and timber harvest at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Or microplastics.
Or microplastics. Or if the Uinta Wilderness has a wolverine present or absent. All those issues, you know, come into the organization and we get to learn about them. I think what's most exciting for me, oh, God, it's so hard to pick.
Let me rephrase the question.
Okay.
In all your time at Adventure Scientists, can you point to a project that really surprised you in some way? The outcome or the process itself really made you rethink something that you thought you knew already?
Yeah. When I started at Adventure Scientists, I didn't know what a microplastic was. And I remember 4.5 years ago or so now, Googling, what is a microplastic? I thought to myself, yikes, this sounds scary, but what is it? And a quick Google search became even more alarming. Microplastics are plastic particles that are less than 5 millimeters in size, and they've been, you know, found in beer, they've been found in honey, they've been found in fresh and marine ecosystems across the planet. And the data set that we've collected since my Google search and, you know, starting before my Google search has really become a powerful representation of how pervasive this issue is. And it's informed not only my own rejection of single-use plastics and my attempts to move away from plastics entirely, but also it's informed Crokey's, who's one of our wonderful partners, manufacturing processes.
Mm.
You know, it's been used by the government of Palau to inform the boundaries of marine protected areas.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new toolkit out that's being accessed by other groups around the world to replicate our local study of our backyard watershed, the Gallatin watershed. And then our global data set is out there. And we've had requests from the EPA, the Outdoor Industry Association, and others, because there's a lot of curiosity about how this pollutant is affecting the planet.
Well, I'm a member of the American Sailing Association, and I just got an email announcing their new project to enlist sailors to tackle this problem everywhere we go.
Absolutely, let's
pick it up. Let's figure out how sailors who are already out there doing their thing can be a part of the solution. And it makes me wonder if your data set isn't something that they looked at and said, okay, it's time to do something.
Yeah, I would imagine they have. The Atlantic Rally for Cruisers is a sailing expedition that collected samples for us on one of their major trips. And that was a huge swath of samples that we were able to collect by harnessing the sailing community.
Yeah.
Really cool. Appreciative for that.
It's a great example.
Yeah.
All of that sounds awesome. But at some point, the accountant enters the conversation and says, okay, cool, but who's paying for all of that? How is this funded?
Sure. We're a mixed fee-for-service and philanthropically driven revenue model.
Fee-for-service, meaning scientist comes to you, they need to pay some for the service.
Right. Yep. Our services are not free. It is very resource intensive to mobilize a global community of outdoor adventurers. You know, we need to fund our salaries. We need to, you know, fund a lot of the analysis. There is a lot of cost associated with these projects. Mm-hmm. They are very, considering the scale we're able to operate on, they're very cost effective because it is volunteer driven, most of the actual boots on the ground data collection. That being said, we do rely on philanthropy hugely to go out and find these projects. You know, a lot of the scientific community isn't aware that this exists. And so we need to go out and let them know and mm-hmm. carefully vet those projects to make sure it is a good application of our network. Because otherwise, you know, we're wasting this incredible resource. And so we spend a lot of time asking ourselves those three questions that I went through earlier to make sure every investment that we take on is the right one and is going to lead to an actionable conservation outcome. And so, you know, my role at the organization is development. I am a fundraiser. And we recently launched an $8 million raise that is really, really exciting because what it's going to allow us to do is to grow the organization from our current portfolio of four active projects to an amazing engine of 10. And we want to get to that point in the next 3 years. And so,
wow, that's speedy.
Yeah. So this effort, this $8 million raise is going to get us there. And that's what I'm doing now is going out and seeking relationships with like-minded groups, like-minded folks who are interested in partnering with us to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. And these volunteers who go out, do they pay their way? Or is there help available to them to buy a plane ticket or something like that? Or volunteerism means, no, I'm going. I'll do this for you while I'm there.
Yeah, it's volunteer driven. It's, you know, they pay their way. Many are going there anyway. Mm-hmm. Many, you know, the location-based example I gave on the West Coast, those are people who have a deep attachment to that landscape. Similarly, you know, we had a partnership with the Forest Service a few years ago in the Uinta Mountain Range where we had ultra runners going out to service camera traps looking for wolverine and lynx in that ecosystem. Those were ultra runners who had to get their miles in anyway. And so they were covering 40 miles in a day to service those trail cameras for us. And, you know, the only bribery we offer is food and beer and some cool swag from our amazing corporate partners.
Well, for most of those people, that would be enough.
Yeah. And yeah, I think the fulfillment is really a lot of the reward.
Well, so whether I'm a donor looking for a place to put money or a volunteer who's heard this and thought, oh my gosh, I totally want to take ice core samples on my next ski adventure, give us a website.
Sure. It's www.adventurescientists.org.
Very simple.
Very simple.
Meryl, thanks for the conversation.
Absolutely. This was really fun.
Think Radio is a production of Alan Wardis Media. To contact Alan, visit alanwardismedia.com.
The show's producer is Issa Forrest. Original music by Issa Forrest. Thanks for listening. Join us next week for another great conversation on Think Radio.